certainly the robots are coming for human jobs just as the AIs are coming for human jobs. One question you could ask is, you know, at what point will AIs and robots be able to do all the work that needs to be done to support human society?
The proliferation of OpenAI's ChatGPT has made the whole world suddenly start to pay attention to artificial intelligence, as well as beginning to ask whether it's a threat or an opportunity. This has created somewhat of an AI arms race, which has fueled interest and investment in AI companies that are creating various AI models. In a recent development, three blockchain AI companies have merged to create the Artificial Superintelligence Alliance. I'm joined by Dr. Ben Gertzel, the CEO of one of those companies, Singularity Net, who's joining us from the Token 2049 conference in Dubai. Firstly, Ben, Singularity Net and Hanson Robotics are behind the world's first humanoid robot, Sophia, who might be well known for our audience from her interactions with celebrities and even governments. What is Sophia up to these days?
Oh, Sophia's traveling all around the world, spreading the good word about human-robot relations. And it's been amazing to see her intelligence grow over the years since she was born or created in 2015. And we're running her mind now on a decentralized network of SingularityNet processors, and we've also got Sophia avatars running in the Sophiaverse metaverse. So she's a very busy digital woman.
Sophia is using generative AI intelligence on the blockchain. How does this AI work, and why is it so important to be on the blockchain?
Well, the blockchain is a technical mechanism to allow a network of computers to operate without any central owner or controller. And so the real question is, why is it better to have the AI operating the global economy, of which Sophia is a part? Why is it better to have the AI not owned and controlled by any small number of parties, but to be controlled and owned in a broad-based and decentralized way? And I guess, to me, that was always extremely obvious. Like, as messy as the whole mess of humanity is, I trust it better than having a particular company or a particular government ruling all of the AI. And that's why I founded SingularityNet back in 2017.
You recently formed the Artificial Superintelligence Alliance with Fetch.ai and Ocean Protocol. What are you hoping to achieve with this alliance?
As you said, Pamela, we're in an interesting phase in the development of AI. We're in an era of an AI race, and to some extent an AGI race, an artificial general intelligence race, a race to create and deploy AIs that can generalize beyond their programming and training in the way that people can, and ultimately even better than humans in a super intelligent way, right? When I started doing AI research in the 80s, it was a fairly modest-sized research subfield. And even when I founded SingularityNet in 2017, AI was not all that popular. Decentralized AI was a quite small corner of pursuit. We were really the first ones to be doing it in a serious way. So now AI is on the tip of the tongue of every national leader, every major corporate executive. Big tech companies have rival AGI research programs pushing hard toward building real thinking machines. And the AGI race is on. I think it's important that the decentralized community wins the AGI race and creates real thinking machines before big tech companies or big governments do, because I think it's important that the first truly intelligent machines are operated and controlled in a democratic, decentralized way rather than by some particular party with their own special interests.
There is a lot of excitement about generative AI, but equally there is a lot of fear. Your vision is for a decentralized AI, but for many, decentralized AI seem risky. Once the cat is out of the bag, it's out. Why are you an advocate of decentralization rather than centralized control of this technology?
Pamela, everything in life has risks. Even the most beneficial technology you can think of could be used in a dangerous way if someone wanted to. But I think, on the whole, decentralized networks are safer and provide more benefit than centrally controlled networks. The Linux operating system is decentralized, owned and controlled by everyone and no one. The internet itself is a decentralized framework owned and controlled by everyone and no one. And I think we're better off because these fundamental infrastructures are decentralized and democratic in operation. We'll be better off if AI and AGI and superintelligence, as they develop, are democratic and decentralized like Linux and the internet.
One of the biggest challenges of AI right now is the compute power, a market which is largely dominated by NVIDIA. OpenAI started as a not-for-profit, but quickly had to change tact amid mounting server costs. How are you funding your decentralized AI?
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting points here. So, you know, NVIDIA is a great company, and what they're doing is amazing in providing hardware to train deep neural models. Now, one of the ways in which I differ from many of the big tech AGI gurus is I don't think deep neural networks, such as large language models, are the whole solution to building artificial general intelligence. I think we're going to get to human-level general intelligence and superintelligence by putting deep neural networks together with other AI methods, like logical reasoning algorithms and evolutionary learning algorithms. And these other kinds of algorithms may work better on different sorts of hardware than what NVIDIA makes. So, I mean, NVIDIA GPUs are important. Multi-core CPUs are important. Innovative hardware architectures like, say, GSI's APU, Associative Processing Unit, are also important. So I think we're going to see a broader variety of hardware types network together in the server farms that deliver AGI over the next few years. Now, as to how we within the Superintelligence Alliance are funding the hardware underlying our decentralized AI, this is one area where our decentralized mode of organization is an advantage. We don't need one big server farm that one party owns. Rather, we have software frameworks such as NuNet and HyperCycle, which allow anyone around the world to contribute the processing power on their home computer or the computers at their place of work. Any computer around the world can enter into the decentralized compute network and help fuel the decentralized supercomputer. So the hardware power itself can be decentralized along with the software that runs on it.
Thank you, Ben. Now let's check in with our resident economist, Alex Holmes. Alex, regardless of who wins the AI race, the early winners are the data processing companies like NVIDIA.
Yes, Pamela, we thought we'd explain some of the processing power required to power this surge in AI. At the end of 2023, there are about 20 million AI chips installed, but analysts estimate that we'll need at least 100 million or more over the next 3 years. This is going to result in a huge investment in terms of CapEx. The new NVIDIA Blackwell B200 GPU, for instance, costs about $30,000 to $40,000 a pop, and there's going to be millions of these things. That's not to mention all of the CapEx to build the data centers to house them and the infrastructure to support the energy costs of running them. Data centers use an extraordinary amount of energy to maintain their servers. They consume about 1,000 kilowatts per square meter, which is about 10 times the power consumption of a typical American home. Where is all this energy going to come from? Already in 2022, data centers used about 1 to 2% of worldwide energy, up from 0.5% in 2000. So these are going to start becoming a significant user of energy in the years ahead. And there is already a lot of discussion about powering them with green energy like solar and battery storage. And there's a whole separate industry that's popping up to support the proliferation of AI. Real estate developers are now building data centers, energy operators are building standalone energy systems to power them, and IT professionals and electricians are physically connecting all the copper wires. So yes, while some jobs in some areas are displaced by AI, new jobs are also being created in the process.
Thank you so much, Alex. Ben, you are what most people would call a genius. You finished high school by year 10 and had a PhD in mathematics by 23. Why is AI so interesting to a mathematician?
No, you're misrepresenting me. I got my PhD at 22, actually. And yeah, I graduated college at 18. And I wrote my first AI code when I was 14, which was not as common a thing to do then. I mean, now we're teaching 8-year-olds in Ethiopia to do AI programming and robotics, right? But in the 70s, that was unusual. But honestly, I've been interested in how the mind works since I was a little kid. I mean, it's just a vexing thing to be an intelligent system, and you have these thoughts pop into your head, and you don't know why. So, my interest in AI really came not out of the practical applications originally. It just came out of a curiosity of how thinking works and how consciousness works. And then, if you're sort of engineering oriented, you feel like the best way to understand something is to try to build it, right? And that made me want to figure out how to build intelligent systems. Mathematics is very interesting to me in itself as a sort of artistic medium, but it also seemed to me the best tool to use to formalize ideas about how thinking works and then connect these ideas with how computers work. And of course, that's how the AI field has been since before I was born, right? I mean, the underpinnings of deep neural networks is, you know, differential equations, like every engineer learns in school. So I think mathematics has been key to AI, just as to physics and every other branch of hard science, really. And what's interesting about what's happening in the AI field now, though, is it's not the work of any one genius or any 10 geniuses, right? It's a huge upswell of creativity by a growing portion of the human population, really. We're seeing so many brilliant people come into AI contributing their ideas, which is building up momentum in a way we've never seen before.
When people don't understand something, their most common reaction is fear. As someone who clearly does understand this subject, is there anything to be fearful about?
I think when I don't understand something, my reaction is not fear. It's more like a wonder or curiosity. And having lived 10 years in Asia, I found that there in Hong Kong, where I live, China, Japan, Singapore, Korea, the default assumption of most people is that when AI and robots become super intelligent, they will be humanity's friends and helpful to people. You know, in America, where I live now and spent much of my life, I do find the default reaction is fear, and people assume robots naturally, what they're going to do when they become really smart is kill everybody. What else would they do, right? So I don't know if that's an inevitable reaction to AI and robotics, but it's a reaction among certain cultures, which are certainly fostered by the movie industry, right? And I think once people see human-level AIs in front of their faces, AIs as smart as people walking down the street, just doing useful, helpful things, I think this fear will probably evaporate fairly quickly once the reality is there. I mean, just as when you present a mobile phone to someone from a Stone Age tribe who's never seen it, they're gonna be freaked out. Then within a week, they're gonna be addicted to it, like to TikTok, like everybody else, right? So the fear will exist among some subcultures. But I think the technology is going to be so useful and helpful that people will quickly just accept it for what it is, rather than buying into the Hollywood fantasies.
Your dad was a sociology professor. How does this shape your views in terms of AI? Is there room for altruism in AI?
You know, my father's biggest lesson to me, I think, was to look at the data and look at the reality rather than listening only to people's stories. He was a very analytical sociologist, and he still is. He's retired, but still active in research. And if you look at the reality of AIs and what they're actually doing, what you see is that it depends quite a lot on how you program them and how you train them and how you teach them. And if you create an AI whose purpose from the get-go is to kill people or spy on people or sell them stuff they don't need, well, that's what the AI is going to do. If you create an AI and configure it with a goal system to be compassionate and helpful and beneficial to people, and if you then train it by working with it side by side in things like education and healthcare and science and creative arts, you're probably going to get an AI that's beneficially oriented to people and wants to help people do things. I don't think it's really that mysterious. I mean, it's hard to have any guarantees when you're going into a new domain, but I think it's pretty clear if you look at the reality of AI that if we set AIs toward beneficial ends and train them and work with them in that way, we're going to get AIs that are compassionate and beneficial to people. The issue isn't that that's such a hard problem. The issue is rather that the AI industry globally is primarily concerned with what I've sometimes referred to as selling, killing, spying, and crooked gambling, right? And plagiarizing now, we can add, with some of the uses of generative AI. I mean, the issue is more that people are putting AI toward non-altruistic ends and explicitly configuring AI that way, right? It's not that it's so hard to make a compassionate, altruistic AI if that's what you set out to do.
You were part of the team who created the world's most advanced humanoid robot. What's your view on AI and robots, and will they start replacing human jobs, and in what time frame?
Well, Pamela, we're already seeing AI replacing human jobs all over the place. And of course, we're seeing robots replacing human jobs all over the place as well, within factories, within warehouses, and on the back ends of various businesses. Now, the kinds of robots I've worked with most are social robots, like Sophia, who you mentioned, or Grace, the humanoid medical robot, Desdemona, who sings in the band where I play keyboard, right? So these sorts of robots haven't yet been as economically successful as factory or warehouse robots, but I do think they're coming. I mean, I think the rate of progress of robotics will be a little bit slower than the rate of progress of AI software, because you have to keep building new factories to embody each advance. But certainly the robots are coming for human jobs just as the AIs are coming for human jobs. But I find the whole question of the obsolescence of human jobs quite fascinating from an economics and sociology perspective, because there are several different questions you could ask. One question you could ask is, you know, at what point will AIs and robots be able to do all the work that needs to be done to support human society? And that may be quite soon, actually. But a different question is, when will we stop creating jobs for people to do? And that might be later. In other words, even once AIs and robots could do everything, people like to work and we like to create jobs for other people. So we may keep creating jobs for each other just because that's our societal momentum, even when AI and robot couldn't do everything or almost everything, right? So these are sort of subtle psychology, sociology, and economics questions. But bottom line is, pretty much everything people do to earn money, AIs and robots will be able to do quite soon. So the robot hardware is very capable now. It's no longer really the problem. The problem is the AGI software, and the problem is just making the robots cheaper and cheaper to manufacture. And both scalable manufacturing and AGI software are accelerating quite rapidly, which I think will pull robotics along with it.
Everyone's fear with AI is that it becomes sentient and eliminates the human race, just like Skynet in the movie Terminator. Is Skynet a foreseeable risk right now?
I don't think, Pamela, that is everyone's fear about AI. I think that's the fear that the media tells people to have, and then some of them latch onto it. But it is a real fear, and I don't think it's totally unfounded. I think the risk that an AI that was created to be compassionate, beneficial, and loving just goes rogue and randomly turns into a sociopath is very, very low. There's no rational reason to think that's a significant risk. I think it's a significant risk that someone creates an AI to squash their enemies and advance their personal interests, and then the AI gets out of hand and does a little bit too good a job of squashing their enemies, right? So I think the important thing to do is to educate our young AGIs in compassion and ethics and human benefit, rather than creating AGIs to spy on people, kill people, and sell them stuff they don't need, right? So I sort of think that raising the risk of rogue super intelligence, like going nuts and killing everyone of its own volition, that's a way of distracting everyone's attention from the obvious risk right now of powerful entities just creating AI to serve their narrow interests and then serving those narrow interests all too well.
A big thank you to our special guest, Dr. Ben Goertzel, the CEO of SingularityNet, and our resident expert economist, Alex Holmes. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of IC Your Trade Season 4. IC Your Trade is brought to you by IC Markets, a leading high-performance trading provider. Trade up to IC Markets. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can watch and listen back the episodes from the past three seasons on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. See you next time.